diaries and things, and I'd say to my mother, don't you read this? You know, she said, well, if you don't want anyone to read it, you shouldn't write it down.
From a secret location in room 100 of 540 Jack Gibbs Boulevard, this is Craft. I'm your host, Doug Dangler.
Zoe Brigley is the author of three books of poetry, The Secret, Conquest, and Hand and Skull, all of which were UK Poetry Book Society recommendations. Her most recently published work is Family Name, co-written with Jenny Mitchell and Roy McFarlane. She will appear at the Ohio Anna Book Festival on April 20th at the Columbus Library Main Branch. More information about that is available at Craft the Show. Welcome to Craft, Zoe Brigley.
Thank you so much for having me, Doug. I really appreciate it.
Well, we're happy to talk to you today. Tell me about your recently co-authored poetry collection, which is co-authored, I think, sort of in name only, because you've got three authors taking turns writing about the same topic of family names. And yours centers on Mary Wollstonecraft. So tell me about that book.
Yes, well, I was so honored because Jenny Mitchell, Roy McFarlane, both wonderful British writers who I know, because obviously you can probably tell by my accent that I'm actually not originally from the States, but I am an American citizen now, which is amazing, originally from Wales. And so I have lots of links around the world with different writers. And Jenny had this idea for us to work together as a team and create a mini book on the theme of family names, which was wonderful. And Jenny has some wonderful poems in there, which are talking about stories of Black women and thinking about their lives and histories and family. And Roy is also a wonderful writer, writes about masculinity, men's relationships, and also about nature and our kind of relationship with nature and the names that we give to the natural world, and kind of thinking about what names might nature give itself if it could. So there are some wonderful poems by Roy. And my poems fitted in with this because I have a new obsession at the moment, which is this wonderful proto-feminist or an early feminist, someone who was a feminist before feminism was a thing, who was this amazing British writer and campaigner, Mary Wollstonecraft. And I've known about her for a while. And I remember reading books of hers when I was a student and thinking, wow, this woman was amazing. She's writing about human rights. She's writing about women. This is all in the 18th century. So I was always impressed with her. But something struck me about her recently, because I was actually reading a biography of her daughter. Now, I don't know if you know the story of Frankenstein, but Mary Shelley, who wrote that book, was Mary Wollstonecraft's daughter. So there's like a whole family of really interesting women. But I was reading a biography by the wonderful poet Fiona Sampson of Mary Shelley. And right at the beginning, there's this absolutely shocking scene, which is Mary Wollstonecraft's death. Because Mary Wollstonecraft actually died after giving birth to her daughter, and it was down to a drunk doctor who didn't give her like proper medical treatment. She should have been fine and she should have survived, but there were some gruesome details of how like he didn't remove the placenta properly, and Mary Wollstonecraft died because of that. And it's an absolute tragic story because she was this amazing woman, an amazing thinker, and someone who really made a huge contribution around the time that a lot of English-speaking culture was thinking about human rights and what it means for people to have rights, which is something that's quite prescient, I think, something we're thinking about a lot at the moment. They weren't the first people to think about that, but they were the first people to kind of write it down and to really create the ideas on which we base our society now. So she's a wonderful, wonderful woman. And the poems that you see in this collaboration, this kind of anthology with Jenny and Roy, are just the beginning. And I want to write so much more about her because her whole life is just so fascinating.
Mm-hmm. And she was a writer for a long time, but also had a very unconventional lifestyle that was somewhat scandalous at the time, not helped apparently by her husband. So tell us a little bit about the background there.
Well, this is really interesting because I think this is to do with the fact that when she was growing up, she had some family difficulties because her father was quite an abusive man. And there were stories about how, like, Mary would sit outside her mother's door to try and prevent her father from going in and, like, being abusive to her mother. So she saw this from a young age. And I think maybe this is something that made her feminism come into being, if you know what I mean, because seeing that must have been something that really affected her. And she really strongly felt that she wanted a different life for herself and she didn't want to be tied down. She also saw one of her sisters was very unhappily married, so much so, and possibly might have had postnatal depression. Mary actually helped her to escape that marriage. So she saw lots of examples of married women who were really in quite harsh and awful situations. And of course, at the time, they didn't have the rights that they should have to just be able to, like, leave the marriage or have some kind of protection. It just wasn't there for women,
right?
Which is really sad. And so Mary Wollstonecraft was convinced that she wasn't going to get married, that, like, if she fell in love, she was just going to live in sin and not get married, which did turn out to be scandalous in the end. There's lots of arguments about who her first love was, but the first really significant man in her life, she actually discovered, and it's quite amusing, really, during the French Revolution. Because while some writers like William Wordsworth, famous romantic poet, and other writers were kind of running away from France and being like, right, we've got to leave. This is a really bad situation to be in. We've got to go. She ran towards it, which is quite funny. She actually decided she wanted to go and see what was happening in revolutionary France. And when she was there, she met this American adventurer called Gilbert Imlay. And they both fell completely in love with each other. They had a mad, like, passionate affair. They were really in love. And she ended up, in the end, getting pregnant, having a daughter, Fanny. And basically, this relationship did not end up going well, though, because Gilbert kind of, in the end, he got tired of Mary, and she began to see how, without marriage, she was also quite vulnerable. So she was left alone with this child, and Gilbert wouldn't answer her letters. And she even became quite suicidal at one point about it because she began to realize that this relationship was over. And although she was still madly in love with him, he had changed his mind about her, which was really so sad. And you read her letters at the time and it's really tragic to look at them and read them. Mm-hmm. But thankfully, this wasn't the end of the story for Mary Wollstonecraft. And she went through a really dark period where she was very depressed and miserable about what had happened with Gilbert. But she goes on to meet this wonderful man, William Godwin, who was also a thinker, a philosopher, a writer, an anarchist. He was a really interesting man. She met him in London and they fell in love, which was absolutely wonderful for her. And what was interesting about it, and I still find it really fascinating, is they both set out with these really high ideals. So obviously she'd had this betrayal by Gilbert Imlay and she was getting over that. And they both agreed that they were going to try and have, like, a real equal relationship with equal respect for each other, equal care, equal respect for each other's work. And sometimes you can see they're sort of rubbing up against each other a little bit and they're having little issues that they have to work out. But they went in there with this wonderful idea of having, like, this perfect relationship. Well, perhaps not perfect, but as perfect as it could be in terms of their respect for each other. And it was very passionate as well. If you kind of look at what they write about each other, they're really very much in love. And for quite a while in London, they lived without getting married, but eventually Mary did start to get tired of it. She was finding that people were treating her differently. She got pregnant again. She was worried about her child and whether that was going to end up with her being treated as a bastard and what the kind of the social aspect of that would be like for her kids. And so in the end, they did get married, but for a long time they didn't, which was really, really brave at the time. And of course, the end of the story was when she actually had Mary, this kind of sad mishap with the doctor and her tragic death. But she was a wonderful, wonderful woman. And I feel there's so much more I'd like to write about her life and the people she knew and how she was mixing with some of the greatest thinkers of the time. It's just a wonderful, wonderful story.
Mm-hmm. And you've included some found poems in your book, Family Name, that derive from Mary Wollstonecraft's writing. So what stands out about text for you as you're reading that you go, oh, this seems like a found poem to me? What is there that makes you go, I'd like to do something with her writing that is different or unusual?
Well, she's a great writer for a start. So it's really easy to find things that you think are like great lines or really interesting. And there's so much that's been written about her as well. After she died, William Godwin, absolutely devastated about her death, actually ended up writing a kind of biography of her. Unfortunately, the thing was that it wasn't absolutely well known, all the stuff that Mary had got up to. So like that she'd gone off and met Gilbert Imlay and not married him and had his kid and all this kind of stuff. Some people knew, but not everybody did. But once William wrote it down, well, everybody knew then. And some people were very disapproving. And I do use some of his storytelling, though, about her, because it is very moving. And you also see her through the eyes of the man who loved her, which I think is very moving. So I use some of that. And also Mary's words herself, for example, her letters to Gilbert. I don't think anything can speak such volumes as her herself and those like plaintive letters that she kept writing in him and that he just kept ignoring and sending back. And there's something about letters as well that I find really fascinating, because in a way, a letter is written from one person to another. We're not really supposed to see it, but I do love to look at other people's letters. I don't know if you've ever done this, but you can find lots of websites have like the greatest love letters in the world, things like that. And you can read famous writers' love letters to each other. And they're absolutely stunning. They're brilliantly written. I do love that kind of thing. And I feel like you're almost kind of eavesdropping on someone. Okay. And so by using bits of found material in the poems, I'm eavesdropping on like Mary Wollstonecraft and William Godwin, how they felt about each other, how Mary felt about certain events in her life. And I feel like there's something really intimate and nice about that.
Does this change how you feel about, in your own life, say, your letters or emails? Because I imagine that as you're looking at these letters and thinking about the people that wrote them, there's an almost unavoidable moment where you think, well, what's going to happen when I die? Will there be people going through my letters? Will they look at my correspondences and draw inferences about my life because of it?
It's interesting, isn't it? And when I was a little girl, my mother always used to tell me this thing. She'd say, you shouldn't write it down if you don't want people to read it, you know? And she always used to say that to me, because I'd keep diaries and things and I'd say to my mother, don't you read this? She said, well, if you don't want anyone to read it, you shouldn't write it down. So I think sometimes we do have this feeling, don't we, that you're writing something to someone and yet you kind of, who are you writing it for? Is it just for that person, or are there things in there that you'd want to pass on? Are there letters you'd like your kids to read when they're grown up? And things you'd like them to know about you. Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting thing. But I am a big letter writer. I love writing letters. Although I do use social media and email more now, I feel like letter writing is just a really interesting way to get to know someone. So I do kind of write long letters to friends and people I care about. And no doubt when the kids grow up and they go off, I'll be writing them long letters too, I expect.
Mm-hmm. And that's all the material that somebody who follows you needs you to do. So everybody listening should be writing things for their children to explore and say, see, I told you mom always liked this or that. It gives you sort of a factual foundation, I guess, to stand on when that person has died or something like that. Yeah, I'm familiar with that. One other thing I wanted to ask you about is that you've become the editor for Wales's leading poetry journal, Poetry Wales, from 2021. What's your experience been like working with poets on their work for publication? Because you've been on the other side, publishing your own, and you get feedback. And certainly you would be giving feedback to students and things like that. But I imagine it's a different relationship when it's a poet who's coming for publication. What's that experience been like for you?
I've learned a lot through actually editing a journal, because one thing that I've realized is that you send poems out to magazines and sometimes you get rejected. That's just the way of things. But I think I've come to realize now, like, just how vast the job is of editors. So for like Poetry Wales, we have like 3 submission periods per year, and we get about 3,000 poems submitted.
Wow.
Each period. Yeah. And I read them all. I read them all. And I think when you're on that side of things, you think, oh, yeah, it's kind of understandable that sometimes you might get rejected, because there's such a vast pool of excellent work. There's so many great writers out there, and you just can't publish them all. And in a way, I tell this story to writers to kind of encourage them and say, look, if you do get rejected, it's not personal, and it doesn't mean that the editor doesn't like their work. The interesting thing is, I've tried really hard since I came into the job to think carefully about tailoring rejection letters as well. So I look really carefully at the work, and if it's a new writer who I think should be encouraged, I try to send them a letter that does that job. If it's someone that I'm really sad to pass on, I think, oh, I love this work, but I can't squeeze it in, I try to tell them that so that they know. I just feel like it's a big responsibility being an editor and having so much work being offered to you that you really have to take a lot of time and care to kind of look after those people. Because from being on the other side of it, I know that sometimes if you get rejected, it can feel personal sometimes. You sort of think, oh, I don't think this journal liked my work. I won't submit to them again. But in fact, I think the biggest, most important piece of advice I could give to writers is to persevere, because I've had writers who've submitted to Poetry Wales say 3 or 4 times, and then the 5th time they get published. And I love those stories, because it's just lovely to see that they persevered, they trusted us. And when there was that kind of magic moment where a poem fitted with a particular issue, it was the right length, it was the right subject, it was the right quality, and then there's that magic moment, you get a yes.
And that must feel pretty good also as an editor to be able to send those acceptance letters. That's the good part of the job.
Oh, I love that so much. Yes, I absolutely do.
And with 3,000 submissions, how many poems get published out of that?
Well, it's about 50 per issue.
Wow.
So it's a very small percentage of the poems. We do try to include some new writers on the website as well. We have a great long-running series called hashtag How I Write a Poem. And it's poets presenting a poem and being interviewed about how they wrote it. And we talk about all kinds of things, like we talk about sonnets, or we talk about prose poetry, or we talk about line breaks or punctuation. It gets very kind of poetry nerd. I like getting into these details. about stuff. And poets seem to really enjoy it. It's kind of something that the poets enjoy being interviewed about it. And it's always interesting to take a poem apart and see, how did this come into being? What ideas went into it? How did you make that form? And what kind of made you choose to do the things you did? So, yeah, I love interviewing the poets. It's a really lovely part of my job.
Excellent. Zoe Brigley, thank you very much for talking to me today. And we're really looking forward to seeing you at the Ohioana Book Festival on April 20th. You'll be there with your books. You'll be there to sign them, to talk to people about them. And people can ask you the same sort of interview questions that you ask poets and ask you about a specific poem and say, is this what you meant here? And then you can be very mysterious or not.
I love that. I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be great. Thanks so much for the great questions.
Thank you.
For more information from my guests, visit www.craftheshow.com. This is Doug Dangler. Until next time, be creative.
All those old
they were wonderful
records,
then.
Those old phonograph records, the ones we used to play so long ago.
Record Store Day arrives this Saturday, April 20th, and Music Journeys celebrates the day with a special rebroadcast of our conversations with five Columbus record stores. Spoonful, Lost Weekend, Records Per Minute, Used Kids, and Love Light. Hear owners reflect on their love of music and vinyl, what makes their shops unique, the value of RSD, and how they handle the day. That's coming up on Music Journeys Saturday afternoon at 3:30 on WCBE, or listen to the podcast with extended features on the five shops. It's available now on Apple, Spotify, and NPR One, or find Music Journeys in our own hub, the podcast experience at WCBE.org and the WCBE app. Thanks to all record stores for everything they do for music lovers.